In 1984, James Cameron thought he might never work as a director again. His first film had been Piranha 2, The Spawning. The movie was an Italian-produced B-horror. It was also the second installment, as you might have guessed, in a series that took so heavily from Steven Spielberg's Jaws franchise that Universal had at one point considered seeking an injunction to prevent its release. Despite being made on a shoestring budget, it was also a tremendous flop. A swift reversal of fortunes after the surprise popularity of the original Piranha. So as Cameron saw it, if he were ever going to get another chance to sit in the director's chair, it would need to be on his own project. Things were not going well. For a time, he was even homeless, living out of his car in Los Angeles while trying to hustle a screenplay that he had been piecing together since he got back from the Piranha 2 shoot. The germ of the idea came from a paranoid dream he had in which he was targeted for assassination by an unstoppable robot from the future. The script was attracting attention, but no one was thrilled about Cameron's insistence on being attached as director. Cameron famously took a huge leap of faith, selling the screenplay for $1 to producer Gail Ann Hurd in exchange for a promise that she would not ditch him as director. Once the studio came to terms with that bitter pill, Cameron says he worked on Terminator, quote, like it was War and Peace, end quote. So he was chagrined when he was pushed to consider for the role of the film's time-traveling hero, Kyle Reese, Arnold Schwarzenegger, an actor whose main credit at the time was playing the title role in 1982's Conan the Barbarian. After taking a single meeting with Schwarzenegger, though, Cameron says he knew the actor could be a star, and if not the hero, then the determined, unbeatable villain. And so Cameron began work on his story of quiet suburban life in Los Angeles, under siege from the terror of the future. With a limited budget again, the movie would become a huge success, launching the careers of Schwarzenegger and Cameron, each of whom would become among the most bankable Hollywood assets over the decades to follow. 30 Mile Zone presents The Terminator. Your tagline this week is the thing that won't die in the nightmare that won't end. I am your host, Scott Frazier, and this is episode 26 of TMZ, the LA Podcast Film Club. Together, we're making our way through the canon of LA movies, exploring representations of the city on film, and asking ourselves what those movies have to say about LA, Angelinos, and the filmmakers. TMZ used to be a subscribers-only show, but now it is available every other Wednesday on the LA Podcast main feed, thanks to our Sepulveda Pass holders. If you want to join the Sepulveda Pass, you can do so by going to thelapod.com, clicking the Support Us link, or by going to patreon.com/LAPodcast. It's just $5 a month. You can help us keep this show going. This one is a bit delayed, and that's because it was I won't say it's a perfect storm. It's just a storm. We had a sick baby. We had the holidays. Reasonable amount of planning could have probably accommodated that, but you have me instead. So on this week's episode, we are talking about a movie that apparently Esquire magazine once called the most important film of the 1980s. It is The Terminator, 1984 sci-fi action thriller, directed by James Cameron, starring Linda Hamilton as Sarah Connor, Michael Biehn as Kyle Reese, and Arnold Schwarzenegger as the Terminator. I have two exciting guests here today. Allison Herman, who is on a considerable streak of joining me on this show, and returning, Hayes Davenport, my long-lost co-host.
Creator of the 30 Mile Zone.
Yeah, I talked a little bit in the intro about how James Cameron came up with the idea for this. You sort of had the dream that became TMZ.
I did, and it's like going to walk around your childhood home, like being back here. A lot of changes. It's free.
Uh-huh.
Less ambitious. We used to say the show where we watch every movie that's ever made about LA. I noticed you've walked that back a little bit.
I have, and yet we also have talked about movies that I think that you and I were probably never going to get to, like Marriage Story is up next, I think.
That's it? Up next.
Oh, that's next?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm so excited for that one.
That does feel like it would have taken a really long time for us to get to that. We had to watch Cradle to the Grave first.
That was the one that scared you off the show.
Yes, forever. That was my last one. So yeah, I'm gonna leave.
But that was a good. I loved the classic intro for the song "X Gun Give It to You."
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you both for joining me. I'm very happy to have you both here talking about this movie, which is actually kind of fun to consider on its own. Much like our last one, Fast and the Furious, it's sort of been consumed by the subsequent mythology of the huge franchise. But I like for myself, rewatching it, I kind of realized that most of my memories about the Terminator had been overwritten by memories of Terminator 2.
Sure, at some absolutely. Point. Yes.
And so it was kind of fun to go back and just see this as a standalone movie. What did you guys think? Had you ever seen it before?
Well, I think I had watched it maybe when Schwarzenegger became governor, because I think there was like a communal, like, let's remind ourselves how insane it is that this man is our chief executive now. I had definitely forgotten a lot. I was also a viewer of the Fox show, The Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Okay. I thought you were going to say The Apprentice. That's future, NBC, though.
No, I escaped that one, but starring future Cersei Lannister, Lena Headey.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
The titular Sarah Connor. So that's, I also am very familiar with like the extended lore of Terminator, and it's very odd to go back to the ground zero of it all.
What about you, Hayes?
I've seen it before. I think as an adult, for sure. But I never, it's fun to think of it as an LA movie. I think people think of Terminator 2 so much more often in general. Yeah. But like that, I think, stands out as like more of a movie that's like rooted in LA.
The river chase scene, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And just like culturally, you know. But I think this one has a lot of interesting LA elements.
Totally
fun to talk about.
Can one of you start maybe with just a summary of the movie? Allison, do you want to do it?
I can attempt it.
This one is, it's interesting.
Well, it's difficult to balance because the way the movie handles exposition, I think, is very artful, but it means that things aren't quite happening in linear order.
Right.
But I'll just start with the story everyone knows, which is in a distant future.
Not that distant.
Well, yeah, like eight years from now.
Yeah, 8 years from now.
Yeah, it's always fun to be reminded that we are headed into a dystopia on top of being
Michael Biehn's character, who comes back to the present day from the future, where he's like a soldier in the resistance against the bad computers, is a Zoomer.
I know, I was thinking that too.
Oh no.
Michael Biehn's character is Gen Z. He was born in like the year 2000.
He was born in like 99, 2000.
Oh my God, yeah. What if the TikTok algorithm is Skynet?
Oh, shit. Yeah. I mean, the next Cold War starts the cybernetic future that we're all doomed to endure. Okay, go on.
I 100% believe that. Anyway, in the not-so-distant future, the machines have taken over. There is a human resistance that is creatively called the Resistance.
Mm-hmm. No hashtag, notably.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They send... First, the machines send the Terminator back in time so that he can kill the mother of the future resistance leader. And then the humans send a human back in time to save the mother of the future resistance leader. That mother is a woman named Sarah Connor. She is a 19-year-old waitress at what is currently a Caro's restaurant in South Pasadena.
And I think was a Caro's back then,
Looks like a Caro's.
And when you say like a Caro's, I have only seen the Pasadena. I don't want to jump ahead to talking about this Caro's, but I was thinking about it a lot. It's a place that you see and you're like, that's a chain for sure. But I have never seen another one. And there's only five. In Southern California.
I went on their website and like they have like the kind of menus where you're like, this is a thing that you've standardized and printed out across several locations.
Wait, yeah. Were there only ever five, or are there just only five?
Maybe
now?
They were all
I think there were
the
a lot more of them.
Yeah, it has the powerful vibe of something
I was actually
that
gonna ask
in the 80s or 90s.
I was gonna ask if the franchise was even still around. So.
That's like in the Coco's calendars.
Exactly. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Vein that
for
is
sure.
Like extremely endangered and is now probably entirely kept alive by like millennials going out of nostalgia. But Sarah Connor is a waitress at this Caro's. And
kind of boomer erasure, I have to say.
I mean, Maybe it's 50-50, but like I've been to the soup plantation, or I used to go to the soup plantation in Atwater Village, and like that was the split. It was like 25-year-olds recreating their childhood and like 75-year-olds who'd been going consistently for 50 years.
And the movie is called Big Jeff's.
Yeah.
Yes, the diner is called Big Jeff's.
The mascot is named Big Buns.
It's truly beautiful. Sarah Connor notices on the news that there is a serial killer on the loose who is killing women named Sarah Connor because the machines know her name, but in the big nuclear holocaust that wiped out the human race, they don't have the identifying details. So instead, Arnold Schwarzenegger's Terminator is just running down the phone book and going after everyone with her name. Let's see what happens. Yes, she goes to Tech Noir, a bar that
she thinks that the serial killer chasing her is Kyle Reese, who is following her.
Yes, she notices a suspicious man following her in the clothes that he has stolen from a closed department store, which the LAPD chases him through. But all the threads converge because we meet Sarah and Kyle and the Terminator all separately. And then everything comes together in a club called Tech Noir that is named after the genre James Cameron wanted the movie to be, which is how all locations should just be named that way in movies. And there's a huge blow up at the club. Kyle takes Sarah away. Mm-hmm. There proceeds to be a chase through a parking garage while Kyle is trying to convince Sarah he is not insane. This is the moment in the movie where they actually do traditional exposition.
Yeah.
And info dump everything, which I thought was fascinating because it almost doesn't need it. It's like very...
Yeah, you've gotten this far, right?
Yeah.
But you could see why she would probably need some of that.
I think it's necessary to lay the groundwork for them sleeping together and conceiving.
But they could have just done the
Sarah
thing.
Connor's son.
They could have just cut to her being like, wow, that's crazy.
And then we don't need anything.
It's all stuff that we already knew kind of from the title cards.
Yeah.
Yes.
They explain a lot. He really gets into the details of like how the Terminator works, which you could see her being like, I don't need this. No, that he's like microchip controlled or whatever. But
I mean, there's the great line that's like, he's going to hunt you. That's what he does. That's all he does.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I think that's the police station, but I'm jumping ahead of myself. They're eventually apprehended by the police because there's been like a well-meaning detective who's been trying to find and help her this whole time. Which is a very, like, it's weird how this movie is both a sci-fi movie and kind of tries to be, like, a straight, just, like, LA crime movie at the same time. So you get the well-meaning detective, and they go into police custody. Sarah tries to finally get some sleep. I love, like, what a plot point, like, the ability to sleep is in this movie. And the Terminator shows up to the police station and just...
kills everybody.
Yeah, says he'll be back and drives a car through the offices. They escape. Kyle and Sarah escape. Kyle also is interrogated by a criminal psychologist before everything goes into flames in an incredible scene. They do sleep in a cave in a park. Try to escape to a motel, but the Terminator finds them by calling Sarah and vocally impersonating her mother in like a truly eerie, wonderful, crazy scene. And comes to the motel and finds them, and things basically culminate in the factory scene from there, right?
Yep. Kyle is killed by the Terminator.
Yes.
Sarah Connor kills the Terminator with a hydraulic press, basically.
Yeah. Earlier, Kyle almost destroys the Terminator by just, like, sliding a stick of dynamite into him, which seems like a real, like, why hasn't everyone figured this out in the future?
Why have the dynamite hole?
But it kind of completes the transformation of Sarah from damsel in distress to a woman who is kind of in charge of her own destiny. And we end in the high desert. You see the Joshua trees. Sarah is pregnant because she and Kyle Reese did have sex when they were in the motel and conceived a child in one go. and she starts recording voice notes for her son, decides to tell him who his father is so he can send his father back in time and make sure he exists. And then a man tells her a storm is coming, and she says she knows, and she drives off into the distance.
It's supposed to be Mexico, but it is definitely like Palmdale or something.
It's like Sun Valley, I think, was my research.
So, I mean, you mentioned like, yeah, so they conceive John in one go. Basically, you have to think for the rest of Sarah Connor's life, she just never has sex again, basically. But it does have this sort of like destiny sort of, I don't know. I guess one of my first questions would be like, we've talked a lot about dystopian visions of LA on this show. There are a lot of them. This is kind of different to mm-hmm. a lot of the other ones that we've discussed on here. I'm curious. I'm just curious how you guys thought about the dystopia in this particular movie. And is this one of the things I couldn't settle on? Is this an optimistic movie or a pessimistic movie? Because there's sort of like in the story, right? They talk about how the resistance has won in the future. All they need to do is preserve that victory. So I wasn't really clear on, is this an optimistic, hopeful message or a pessimistic message of the future is going to be hell on earth, basically?
We talked about this a little bit off mic. This movie is a very interesting and weird relationship to time travel. Like, it does not touch any of the deterministic questions of like, are we changing the future? Do we want to change the future? Is it ethical to change the future? I gathered doing some research on this that in earlier drafts, there was some explicit Sarah tells Kyle that they should destroy the company that makes the software that should eventually become Skynet. And Kyle explicitly says, like, it is not my job to change the future. It is my job to protect it. But the movie really does not weigh itself down with the convolution of time travel, which has the effect.
It makes none of it makes any sense. And I think he was aware of that and is just like,
the more
the premise is
it.
Great. It's a really, really good premise. And it's just, we just all have to accept that that's what it is.
Well, it's also like the movie just doesn't have the budget to like dystopia up LA. It had the budget to shoot like three scenes that look like they could be anywhere because it's pitch black. Mm-hmm. And then they shoot the rest.
Mountains
just, like,
of skulls.
In LA.
That was my favorite.
Right.
Yes.
So yeah, the version that he made 8 years later is like much better realized. He had the effects for it.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen like quotes of his where he talks about like, Arnold doesn't really make any sense to play this, what's supposed to be an infiltration.
Yeah. To seem human.
Yeah, exactly. Or someone you'd be like, what the fuck is that? Like, and the idea that Michael Biehn like doesn't know which one is the Terminator when he's walking into a club, it's like, that's the Terminator.
Yeah, right.
And he also talks about how like the accent, he was like, where you're like, hopefully you just buy that they haven't figured out the voice stuff.
Yeah,
yet.
I was like, are robots Austrian in the future? Is that what happens? But
it's funny too, like there's another scene, one of the scenes that's set in the future, you actually have, because one of the major plot points of the movie, and it comes back in subsequent films, is that dogs can tell that you have a human infiltrating cyborg, and nobody else can tell. And so in one of the future scenes, they have what is a much better version of an infiltration robot that is pretending to like, you know, wave at kids and stuff like that. And then the dog freaks out and it kills everybody.
Well, speaking of the fact that Arnold is so obvious, that was one of the first things I thought of, because the first time you see him, he's naked, because we learned that's the only way you can travel through time. You can't bring anything not living with you. But
unless you wrap it in human skin, then it's okay.
That's right.
But it's supposed to be and is like incredibly striking to see this like hulking dude's naked body. But I was looking at him and was like, to my like 2021 poisoned eyes, like that just looks like an actor now, because we made everyone look like Arnold Schwarzenegger just to have a career.
Certain pieces of his, I think, are still like unusual. The pecs are different. Weirdly, his lower body is basically normal, which you see his entire butt like in the second or third shot of the movie. It's full frontal as well.
Actually,
that happens immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, setting the tone, the movie also is full topless later, which we can talk about.
Right.
Like the hard, like at least PG-13 potentially R-ness of this was very surprising to me on rewatch.
Yeah. The version, like the mythology that I think makes the most sense in the movie is that Arnold Schwarzenegger exists in this universe, and that the Terminator was created to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And it's LA, so everyone plays it cool and is not like Conan the Barbarian. Yeah. Everyone's like,
exactly,
whatever.
So, like, okay, so to your question about like how LA is portrayed in this and like the dystopianness of it, like we don't really see much of like anything identifying LA as a city in the shots from like 2029. It's just like the skulls being crushed. Yeah, just rubble, exactly. But the quote, like the present day LA, I think is very unsympathetic to the city. It feels like kind of a deserving victim of this killing machine.
Right. I mean, our first scene we have, Arnold Schwarzenegger comes out in Griffith Park. There's a gang of street punks
at the Griffith Observatory, where all the punks hang out at night,
including
it's a rebel. They're rebels without a cause.
Yeah. They're hiking at night. They're going. They're getting their steps in, going up the hills.
Bill Paxton, one of the punks. Also, everyone in this movie ended up being in Aliens, basically. And yeah, there's the street punks, and then like Michael Biehn comes down, and there's like this this wino that he steals like the pants from, all these like archetypal characters. There's like the even like the young people, Linda Hamilton's roommate and her boyfriend who's like an asshole.
Yep.
Like basically everyone except Linda Hamilton feels like, okay, so this is like a slasher movie. Right.
Thank you. Yes.
Like that's just purely what it's very close to Halloween.
I was going to say it is very close. I was going to say in terms of genre, it feels like a monster movie, like a slasher movie. There are points in this movie where the shots that you get of Arnold Schwarzenegger, I was like, he just looks like Boris Karloff.
Yes.
Just like completely reanimated up on the screen. I absolutely agree with that.
I mean, the scene where the roommate is listening to music on her headphones, and that's the first detail you get, is that she loves her Walkman because this is the 80s, so everyone loves their Walkman.
Yes.
But the scene where she's just like in the kitchen, and first she's scared, but it's just the iguana, and then he walks in, like that is as classic slasher of a scene as I think you can get.
And when they just had sex and then they get killed.
Yep.
There's like jump scares all the way through the movie.
Right.
But I sort of feel like Linda Hamilton is like the final girl.
Yep.
And the rest of LA is like all the corrupted, like the people that...
The deserving victims.
Yes, like the deserving victims. Exactly.
I mean, once she's gotten woke and taken the red pill, she gets out of there.
That's right.
So.
That's right.
I mean, even in the tagline that we heard above, the thing that won't die, right? It seems like it's a very like 50s monster movie sort of tagline. But yeah, I absolutely agree with that. It was something that really didn't stand out to me that much. First of all, when I first watched this, I don't think that struck me at all. But in subsequent rewatches, it just becomes really plain that's the way that this is framed. And I kind of love it. Like you have this framing where Arnold Schwarzenegger just appears. We already talked about like how absolutely bizarre his appearance is in the context of LA. And he just like comes out and he rips the heart out of these punk, like literally rips someone's heart out. And it just sort of, you have all of these one-dimensional stereotypes who are getting annihilated and sort of just like, I don't know. It seems like there's a commentary being made about the, I mean, it's not like a super deep commentary, but it's like a commentary on the frivolity of what people are doing in the face of, well, AI is a frequent sort of punching bag in movies in terms of what people should be afraid of. But then you also have things like the Cold War, which of course in the mid 80s, America is in the middle of one of the hottest points of the Cold War. And I'm kind of curious, like, how does this particular monster, why was it so resonant with people at that time? Like, why was this version of when Cameron says, "I had a dream about a robot assassin from the future," to me, it doesn't sound like something that I would jot down and then like see right through to completion. But like, it really was resonant to people, obviously, at the time. It was the number one movie in America for weeks, including into the election weekend where Reagan was elected and
re-elected
mm-hmm. in the biggest landslide in American history.
Yeah, I mean, well, also to your point about it being a monster movie, speaking of like T2 overlapping the memory, I think there's a good reason for that, which is that the Terminator is a real character in T2, like mm-hmm. that has desires and wants. And the Terminator in the Terminator has 14 lines of dialogue, one of which is "fuck off, asshole."
Yeah. And he has to think about it first, which I like.
Yeah, he has to select from a menu of options and decides that "fuck off, asshole" is the most appropriate one for the hotel janitor, which, like, speaking of making LA look like shit, mm-hmm. we don't have SROs like that anymore.
No.
I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But yeah, I mean, he, like, is this automaton with an Eastern European accent, like, I think we have kind of moved past the point of harmful Russian stereotypes in American blockbusters, but I don't think it's a coincidence that this mm-hmm. is the Cold War movie. It's pretty overt of the, you know, our technological rivals are going to come and destroy us.
Mm-hmm. Well, he also always had, he was for a long time the highest paid actor in the world, right? And I think throughout like most of the latter half of the 80s and the 90s. So he always seems like he had this dual appeal where he's very charismatic and yet you can use him as he is obviously being used in the Terminator as this sort of like Nazi Superman yeah. sort of stand-in, right?
The closest, I don't know what year this would have been, but I get like the closest bad guy in a movie from probably around this time is like Ivan Drago.
Yeah.
Who is like a super soldier type character from Eastern mm-hmm. Europe, like same type of thing. So I think that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, I think the fact that Arnold is kind of gentle, even in this movie, I don't think it totally comes off. Obviously, the movie was really successful, but I don't know how afraid of this character people really were, as much as they were like, this is cool. And you can see why a movie where he is the protagonist
yeah.
would be 10 times as successful, or
giving the thumbs up at the
yeah
the iconic thumbs up as he's melting
for sure. And it was this movie, it's very rare and it's never happened really in a slasher movie that the bad guy, that the movie comes out and people are like, oh, the monster should be like a leading man yeah. in movies now. And that's what came out of this.
Ivan Drago and Rocky, Sylvester Stallone actually was considered for, or I believe offered, the role of the Terminator and turned it down. So there's a whole 80s action star universe going on.
Yeah, and I mean, Cameron had also, or I believe would shortly after this, like write Rambo 2 or something like that. So like the action world in the 80s was pretty small. I mean, but it was also immensely popular, right? Like
yeah.
Stallone and Schwarzenegger were the two most highly paid actors in Hollywood at the time.
And
later
Gibson
80s.
Also turned it down, which thankfully for all of our ability to enjoy
for
this
posterity.
Movie. And then the funniest bit of trivia about the Terminator is apparently O.J. Simpson's name came up and they were like, no one would buy him as a killer.
Yeah. And yet, I mean,
maybe they would have found out some stuff and people wouldn't have been so surprised, you know.
But in terms of like the way that this movie, I don't know, the way that it connected with people, I think is something that's really interesting to me, because we have, I think, pretty clearly an America that was like, you know, this like morning in America Reagan time, right? And you have that message resonating. You have the LA Olympics, which mm-hmm. closed 2 months before this movie premiered. And so I kind of like, I do kind of wonder, like, you have this sort of messianic deliverance story of this movie. And I'm kind of wondering, and I don't know, like you were saying, the Terminator is a character that resonated with people, not just as a villain. People thought it was emblematic of just like really cool to just have this hyper masculine killing machine.
Yeah.
It really worked for people. And I do kind of wonder, just like, there does seem to be a decided balance there where they say this is a movie about the coming dystopia and our fears about the world ahead, but also there is a path to victory.
Well, it's like,
and also an assured victory. You're getting told we do win at the end of this. It's in that way.
Well, it's like, we have to protect, we have to preserve. Like, the Terminator is an infiltrator and you have to fend him off. So I think that's kind of how you reconcile that.
But like, that's the 84 Olympics is interesting, because we watched a movie for this show called Let It Fall, the documentary about the riots. And that movie talks about 84 and the Olympics as like this time of great optimism about LA and like this boosterism being at this high, and like palm trees and rollerblades, and like that was like the image of LA that was being presented to the world, and that the people that were living there sort of believed it. But this movie makes me kind of question that, because I think it is a very pessimistic portrayal of the city. One reason for that is, back to the idea that this is a slasher movie, it feels like you could never really do a slasher movie set in like New York. But you can do it in LA,
right?
Because of how isolated all these characters are, because like, you do feel like someone could go house to house just like killing people. We have serial killers here. You don't really have, who's the New York serial killer? We have like 10.
Berkowitz. Yeah, we have a lot. We actually are still finding out about more LA serial killers. Like,
that's right.
To this day. I absolutely agree with that, though. That's a very good point. And one of the things too that, I mean, to that point, one of the things that I think is interesting is like the different portrayals of Angelinos in this movie. We talked about the punks. We talked about some of them, but I think like the interactions at the Caros, at Big Jeff's, are right, like
the shitty kid.
Yes.
Okay. Like, okay. Talk us through what happened. This is our introduction to Sarah Connor as a character, right?
And this is supposed to be like kind of the LA as this person's life as it is, and this is the closest thing to,
this is normal.
Yeah, normal suburbia type stuff. And I think for kind of some normal slasher movies, you'd see like the final girl and her like boyfriend, like holding hands and like talking about prom or whatever. But in this movie, she's a waitress. She's waiting on a table. She has all of their orders wrong. A kid takes a scoop of ice cream and puts it like in her, apron pocket. And her coworker very presciently says, think of it this way, in 100 years, who's going to care?
Right.
The restaurant serves something called Burly Beef.
Yes, Burly Beef.
I don't want to know what that is. Another slander on Los Angeles of this movie. Our food is so much better than that.
Yes, but it sucks. Like, everything you see about L.A., the LA that the Terminator is entering into. He shows up at Griffith Observatory.
Right.
One of the nicer like tourist destinations in the city. And he finds a garbage truck and three punks.
Yeah.
And no views, even though if you literally like tilted the camera 2 degrees to the right, it would show the most stunning vista you could possibly
find.
They
don't even bother. It sucks.
Yeah, I know. Her coworker's line is so funny, because it's like, yeah, your life is miserable, but on the bright side, you're also inconsequential. And that's like sort of the best, that's sort of the best case scenario. That's the best you can hope for if you're in Sarah Connor's situation. But as it turns out, that is not meant to be, because she is fated to be what she calls later the mother of the future.
Yes.
Which is pretty great.
And so that's the optimism sort of this movie, is that our present day, like Michael Biehn says, like, he's there to protect the future. He's mm-hmm. not there to change. He's not there to stop it from happening. And we're supposed to get to this victory. And so it's almost like, it's cool. Like, everything, this horrible world that we've created for ourselves is going to be like wiped clean. And we're going to have this new beginning that's like currently growing in mm-hmm. the protagonist's womb.
How much of this movie is about John Connor, who is basically like a MacGuffin? Like, he's not a real presence in this movie other mm-hmm. than the fact that all of the plot revolves around him.
He ends up being the cast. I mean, like, honestly, that these movies were so successful despite the casting is very weird. Linda Hamilton is perfectly cast.
Mm-hmm.
Arnold, as we talked about, is like great, perfect casting for the sequel. Not really that great for this movie.
No. Yeah.
And then the fact that he would choose Edward Furlong to be this like savior
mm-hmm.
character, and who is like, like so annoying.
I mean, it's like, it's actually like, I feel like it works almost well in Terminator 2, because you've waited almost a decade and you're like, man, this guy is going to kick ass when he shows up on screen, and he's just a little brat. Like, he's just like this little nothing of a kid. The casting is,
I mean, if
strange.
I grew up with my mom literally thinking I was the Messiah, like, I would not turn out great either.
That's right.
In fairness to him.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, the as we talked about, like, you know, determinism not playing that much into it, and yet, like, we have, or at least the questions around how determinism would function. But then you have, like, really, there's no justification given as to, like, why is this guy so important to the mm-hmm. future? Kyle Reese says, there was one man who told us that we could fight back and like, test the fences or whatever. It's like, I'm sure somebody else.
I mean, it's weirdly,
they kill this guy and nobody else is like, hey, what?
And an algorithm decided that too, that was the only way that they could win, is by going back and stopping this person from ever being born. That's what the computers also think is the only possible route to victory for them.
So it is basically techno messiah at that point.
Although, like, in a way, if you think about it, like, he becomes the chosen one because he's raised by someone who knows what's going to happen. Like, he's basically just like a delivery device for Sarah's data and her brain to be transferred to everyone else. Linda Hamilton is perfectly cast. I did want to mention, the character is canonically supposed to be 19 years old in this movie, and Linda Hamilton is in her mid-20s.
I never would have guessed that.
Yeah,
and it doesn't come up at all, does it, in the movie? Do they mention
it? No, it's because of, like, chronology, I think, when you see John Connor as a 10-year-old in the subsequent movie. Like, if you do the math, the Sarah Connor in this movie is supposed to be 19 years old, which she does not look like mm-hmm. or act like, but was just like a fascinating detail when I dug that up.
She's a very beaten down 19 years old.
Just even the fact that she's in her mid-20s, but this is like, people back then just looked older.
True.
Michael Biehn is like 28.
I was going to say, you didn't even mention Michael Biehn as far as casting goes. Like, he just sort of, I don't know.
He's whack.
If you were like putting together this cast from scratch, it's hard to imagine. Well, first of all, that people could even remember who was playing that role. But yeah, that part definitely stood out to me casting wise. The thing that I would say, though, in terms of the difference between Sarah Connor's character, who takes up and is the final girl and takes up most of the plot of this movie, and John Connor, I just kept coming back to, like, sort of like you were saying, Allison, like, is Sarah Connor just the delivery system for John Connor, this hero of the future? Is this movie actually about her, or is it about her unborn son? It's
yeah
you know, what is intended for us to think about Sarah Connor, who, I mean, in the second movie, in what I think is very well done, she is put in a mental institution because of the events of this movie, basically.
The movie loves her. Both movies really love her,
yeah.
I think. I do think that, like, despite the fact that it's, like, technically about her son that saves everyone, I think she is just kind of, like, the prized object of the movie, basically. And just like even the way like
Kyle has that whole monologue about how he fell in love with her.
Exactly. He saw her picture in the future and fell in love with her. That's one of the reasons he came back, was because he was in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
And also you're supposed to be like, she gets stood up to before going to
by
the bar.
The voice of James Cameron.
Oh, that's his voice.
Yes, that's him on the answering machine, which is really funny because you then know of his own romantic future / now history with Linda Hamilton.
Exactly.
Like, it's very hard for me not to project my own knowledge of like James Cameron's relationship with women onto this. But like, if I factor that out, I actually think Sarah Connor is an incredible action / horror heroine, and her arc from kind of blasé waitress to damsel in distress to like the person who ultimately takes the Terminator out is just like a very great wordless arc that she undergoes over the course of the movie. Like, I agree with Hayes, even though if you think about it, she's kind of the delivery device for John Connor. I would flip it and say John Connor is the delivery device for Sarah's knowledge that she wins the hard way.
And the movies like this and like Kill Bill make you think like movies that are in love with a protagonist like work in some way. They work on the viewer very successfully, like seeing how an auteur who like really, really is into this character, like that's infectious, but it's also weird.
Yeah.
Like it's weird.
I mean, it does seem like when you're hearing Kyle Reese be like, yeah, I saw this picture of you and I fell in love with you. It does feel, I mean, it is James Cameron's word. It seems very much like,
I just was thinking about like that Tina Fey, Amy Poehler joke, like the one that like truly put them in the Hall of Fame was Catherine Bigelow made this movie about torture, but it was nothing compared to being married to James Cameron. And I was like, right, it's so weird that he created this like iconic female sci-fi character and future custodian of Ripley. Like,
right.
Yeah.
Very strange.
I want to see if you noticed one thing. It's almost like an Easter egg in this movie. It pretty much every movie we ever talked about on this show featured a particular LA institution that is all over in this movie, but is not mentioned by name. Did you notice?
I feel like I may have, but I also need to know the answer.
They don't say LAPD. And when
they say city police,
when the Terminator steals a cop car, it like passes by. And you see on the side of the car, it says in quotes, to care and to protect.
It doesn't say protect and serve, no.
Yes, and the logo says Metropolitan Police.
Metropolitan Police. We had that in Fast and the Furious too. MPD.
Really?
Yes.
I wonder why in some movies, well, first of all, I don't know, do you have to get permission? I don't think you do.
I can't imagine that you
would. But maybe
would.
To like, if you want to like use some resources, you want to use a car.
Right.
Maybe you have to clear the content or something. And so then they're like, let's just change the name.
And so actually, that one was funny in Fast and Furious because they had Metropolitan Police Department, but then they just said FBI. And then in subsequent movies, I think they just use the FBI as well. But yeah, no, I didn't. I noticed the Karen.
To care and to protect.
Yes.
To care and to protect, yeah.
Well, this movie was also extremely like not shot above board. So it would not surprise me if they were just like, we're just not going to deal with permits and stuff. Like a lot of this movie was shot on the fly. Like there are actual randos who were not paid background players in certain shots. They really flew by the seat of their pants.
I think the arc for Linda Hamilton's character is fantastic. I like the scene at the LAPD or the Metropolitan Police Department precinct is really good. I mean, for a number of reasons. It's one of those things where the attention to detail is great, and just like having the weird inclusion of the criminal psychologist is like really fun, and he sort of just like lampshades the entire premise. But I think that scene is really important to Sarah Connor's development, because you have that sort of classic slasher trope of going to the people who are supposed to protect you, and then this like unstoppable killer so that sort of becomes right, like a realization that if you're going to survive, you have to do it on your own, right? Mm-hmm. At that point, the entire precinct gets wiped out in a way that we've actually surprisingly also seen in other movies, I think, that we've watched for the show and we'll see more of in the future. Mm-hmm. Any other scenes that you guys particularly liked or want to talk about for this one?
I did want to briefly highlight the fact that this movie does have, like I mentioned before, a real sex scene. The phone sex scene, yeah. I did not remember at all and was like, oh my God, like this is such a, like this would never be in an action or horror movie made in 2021. Just like a completely like sort of necessary to the plot and that it establishes who the character is, but they let the joke play out for like 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's just like such a delightful detour that I so enjoyed.
It's like a De Palma light sort of scene. Like, I mean, the way that his movies were always on the verge of getting rated X, like this one is like sort of the middle school version of that. I don't know, but I loved that detail. And yeah, it is funny, like the full frontal male nudity, the topless nudity from Linda Hamilton or a body double, I'm not sure. That is something that just feels very, very, God, I don't even know what the word is. Jarring? I don't know. It's weird.
We just had our first sex scene in the MCU and it's like chest up missionary and it lasts for 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And like this is what becomes a huge franchise, although as we were talking about off mic beforehand, they really don't like put any stank on the iconic lines because they were not planning for I'll be back or come with me if you want to live.
Which he doesn't even say in this movie, right?
Yeah, it's Kyle.
Kyle Reese says
yeah.
it.
I was saying that they feel, considering how famous those lines are, they feel completely
very
thrown away.
Off, yeah. Totally. One thing I liked, sort of the LA-ness of it, is a lot of something you wouldn't see in a lot of slasher movies, although Michael Myers does do this, but the first thing that the Terminator does after Michael Myers, also first thing he does is kill someone for his clothes, but then what he does right after that, he steals a car.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Which you would have to kind of answer in this, like, well, how is he like getting all the way to like Tech Noir and then
back to downtown?
Now he's at Van Nuys. Like, how does he
get Big Bear
there
at one point?
Yes.
Not even the Terminator can run across LA.
But yeah, any other slasher movie, like once Michael Myers like gets to the town or whatever, you don't think that he's not really like driving around.
Yeah.
Like, but the fact that the Terminator drives everywhere is very funny.
I loved Tech Noir as a concept. And yes, just like, it reminded me of, it reminded me strongly of the club in Scorsese's After Hours which is like a punk club or whatever in the 80s. And I'm super curious how many of these places were out there with just like barbed wire. And I mean, this one seemed at least like it was a friendly, inviting place.
Sure.
Although James Cameron might not have looked favorably.
I think he hates it. Yeah. I think he hates Tech Noir. One question I have, I just do not know the answer to this. So Linda Hamilton and her roommate, the actual location where they live is it's on Lafayette Park Place, near MacArthur Park. Would what was that neighborhood like at the time? Would two 19-year-olds be like living on their own, like near MacArthur Park? Like
the street address that is given for her residence, I think, is Van Nuys, if I'm not mistaken.
That makes more sense.
Like, I think it is not supposed to be that neighborhood, even though like they shot in that neighborhood.
That makes way more sense. I'm curious. I have actually no idea what MacArthur Park in like 1984
that would have been in the middle of the enormous immigration wave, I think.
I would have said the beginning. Yeah.
Sure. From Central America. Mm-hmm. So it probably was a neighborhood in transition. It probably honestly was a lot more Mexican at the time and saw a lot more immigration from Central America.
Yeah.
I think. Any last thoughts about this movie before we go?
Yes, just in case I don't get to do the T2 episode. My LA experience related to this movie is once I was walking down Broadway downtown and there was a group of black Israelites.
Always.
Yes. And they held up a sign that said, "Whites, prepare for your future." And it was a screenshot from like the first 2 minutes of Terminator 2, that skeleton holding the fence and getting vaporized by the blast.
Yes.
And I was like, that's cool. That's, I guess I'll get prepared for
that. That's incredible. I mean, I think my final thought is just to bring full circle. It's so insane that Arnold Schwarzenegger was the governor of California.
Yes.
I forget it and I remember it like three times a week.
But watch this, like seeking an explanation for it, there are some shots where he just has an inherent likability and just, I mean, I cannot tell you how big a deal it, like, to just say, like, from this movie where he is killing all these innocent people, mm-hmm, and is just like seen as like a source of like pure terror, to be like, that guy should star in every movie he's in from now on. Like, has that ever happened before?
Yeah,
I don't think
it's,
so.
I think it is completely without parallel. And I would say that my last thing is, Cameron, of course, loves the technological stuff. One of my first notes about this movie was, I wish I loved anything as much as James Cameron loves a hydraulic forklift.
Yes. 'Cause
he just, man, like the first shot of the movie.
First two shots, you see like a rotating like tread, mm-hmm, that's crushing the skulls.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a gleaming garbage truck prong.
Yes, exactly. But the one that really stuck out to me, of course, T2 has like the liquid Terminator, which is holds up very well, actually. But in this movie, what really stuck with me and was very unpleasant for me to watch is Arnold Schwarzenegger pulls something out of his skin and then also like rips off the skin from his face.
Yeah.
Very affecting special effects, but also just...
I'm very sensitive to like eyeball horror.
Yeah.
And the scene where he like punctures and then rips off his eyes.
Yeah, it was
just awful.
Which is interesting because the movie doesn't use a lot of gore. I mean, there's like the first thing, he rips a guy's heart out, but then he, like, often when he kills people, it's very like conspicuously off screen.
Mm-hmm.
When he kills the first
gun store owner,
you see like the barrel of his gun, but you don't, there's not even any blood.
Right.
I assume that part of that's a budget issue because the movie was so cheap, but it's just interesting what he chooses to use special effects on and what he doesn't.
That is our show for this week. We will be back next time with Marriage Story. I'm very grateful to have had Allison and Hayes, both of you, joining me today. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.